You are listening to the Fortune Geek Heroes podcast. For more fun and previews of our up-and-coming projects, please go to thefortunebooks.com. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the sixth episode of the Fortune Geek Heroes podcast. I'm joined today by Kate Russell, who's trying to promote her Kickstarter. Hooray!
Yay! Well, actually, I've been doing a bit of a rubbish job promoting it recently, because it seems to just be sort of have a life of its own, and all I have to do is sit back and keep the forces entertained in the chat thread on the Kickstarter, and it seems to be doing it itself.
Well, congratulations, you've already made the target now, haven't you?
I know. Do you know what? I made the target in 4.5 hours. It was ridiculous. Whoa. It was an absolute ride, actually. I'll tell you what happened was, I've been following the Elite Dangerous Kickstarter, so I don't know how much you know about that, but they decided that David Braben and his crew decided they're going to make a Kickstarter to fund the next iteration of Elite, which was the game that got me into gaming when, you know, back in 95. Back in 83, I think it was, when it first came out with the first iteration. And so they're running this Kickstarter, and I sort of get back from Christmas and sort of start getting, you know, properly wound into it and going, oh shit, you guys aren't going to make your target. So I said, oh, can I interview David and see if I can maybe get it placed a few places and drum up some publicity. And one of the things that they were doing is they were selling licenses to write a piece of fiction in the part of the Elite Dangerous Kickstarter. And a bunch of people were funding their purchase of those licenses at £4,500 by running additional Kickstarters. So it's a kind of convoluted process that people were going through. And a bunch of people on Twitter said, "Oh, you should go for one of these writing licenses as well." And I'm very easily led, so I kind of like, you know, jumped on the bandwagon and went, "Yeah, all right, I'll do it." And decided to actually run my Kickstarter. Most of the other Kickstarters for the books were running concurrently with the Elite Dangerous one, and to end a few days before so that they would know if they'd got funding. And I just said, well, everyone's skint. You've all blown everything you've got this month on Christmas and the Elite Kickstarter, so I'll take a chance that you're going to fund it, and I'll run my Kickstarter for 35 days so it goes into February to give you a chance to replenish your pay packets. And I launched it, I think it was on the 29th of December, and 4.5 hours later, I'd achieved my Douglas Adams-inspired goal of £4,242. 4.5 hours, so I was just blown away.
I've only just noticed that, 42.42.
Oh, yeah, have you noticed as well the ending date and time?
It's
the 4th of February, 4-2, and then the time is 8, which is 4 plus 2, 42. So there's a whole bunch of 4-2, 4-2, 4-2 in there to please all the Douglas Adams fans.
Oh, lovely, yeah. So tell us a bit about the game then, because I've only just recently checked into the game.
Well, if you want to check out how a lot of us played it when back in the day, back in the early 80s, then you should go along to Oolite, I think it's .org, it's OOLITE, and that's a sort of a fan-created remake of the original Elite. But I got into it. It was on the BBC Micro. We had it. I was very lucky to have a brother who was very into computers and a family that could afford a BBC Micro back in those days. And we got Elite, and it was this 3D line drawn space universe, and it was a space trading game. And the game playing space was basically built using procedural generation, so it was a sort of an infinitely ever changing playing board on which to roam. And it was actually the game that really defined the sandbox genre, which you'll know, you know, sort of Grand Theft Auto is the classic modern game from that genre. Before that, all games really on home computers were just simple remakes of the arcade games, which were all about three lives. You know, they were all about the coin drop. They were about getting you to shove more coins in to give you another 5 minutes gameplay, and you had to get a high score. And they were pretty one-dimensional in terms of their playing, their gameplay. And Elite was a game that really broke that mold. And I remember seeing my brother playing it and looking at this. You know, at the time, computers, nobody knew about computers. So this box on the table in the living room, it was like witchcraft that it had this infinite universe inside of it. And I don't want to sound wanky saying an epiphany, but I did have a bit of an epiphany, I guess, at age 14, thinking there is just something going on inside this box that I don't understand yet, but I really want to know more about what it can do. And that was what really kicked off my love affair with computers and technology. You know, I went to a girls' grammar school at the time, and my lessons were home economics and needlework. So, you know, it was a real escape for me for having to learn to good deportment and how to be polite. And we actually had an ironing lesson. It was a girls' school. We learned how to iron a man's shirt. Would you believe? So that was my elite.
Pretty crazy, yeah. I used to play a game. I used to play Asteroid when I got my first computer.
Right. Yes. And yeah. Asteroid. Again, that, you know, that was, it was kind of like, if you can imagine. I guess we saw Elite as Asteroids on on steroids. It was, you know, it was still a 3D line drawn universe, but you could travel in all directions. It wasn't just a scrolling sort of left, right, up and down. You could go deep into space. And I remember traveling, you know, thinking. Even back then, I was a cynic. It was like, okay, so they're saying this is a never-ending universe, but there must be an end to it somewhere. And I travelled, I think, for about 4 hours in one direction. And there were billions and billions of star systems in this game. You literally could not reach the edge of it. And the point of the game was to, to pick up goods and produce on one planet and then take to another star system, another planet, in order to, you know, raise your funds so that you could improve your ship and buy upgrades and enhancements to your weapons. And then you could do career path choices, like you could choose to be a trader and upgrade your carrying capacity, and or you could decide that you were going to be a naughty pirate and upgrade your weapons, and or perhaps even you would take a risk sometimes and trade in slaves or narcotics. But then you ran the risk that the police would come and hunt you down in their Vipers, and you'd get into a whole load of trouble. So it was a really multi-dimensional game that actually in the early 80s, a shame more city bankers didn't learn the ethics of trading in that game, because we might not have had the problems that we had in the 80s. But anyway.
Well, so they're trying to revamp it then for the new Kickstarter, are they?
Oh, it's totally revamped. I mean, there was Elite. The first Elite came out with Line Drawn Universe, black and white. Then in 93, I think it was, there was Elite 2, which was Frontiers. Then there was a third one, which was, I can't remember the name of it. There was Elite 3, which was in 95, which was an absolute disaster and ended in litigation for David Braben and Game Tech, the publishers. That was in 95. So they like making us wait for our sequels on the Elite franchise. So it's now, what are we, 21 years later, and we're going for the next generation of Elite. And if you have a look on the Kickstarter, and in fact on their forums as well, they've got Frontier, have got a website, and they've got forums running. The gameplay and the graphics that they've been teasing everybody with are, as you would expect from modern space simulation games. You know, they're super, super lovely graphics. There's some really,
yeah, I've seen those. They look awesome, yeah.
And, you know, there's talk about expansions in the future to maybe let you walk on planets, and, you know, and the great thing as well about this iteration is for the first time the game will include massively multiplayer online features. So it was always just a solo game before, where you were playing, you know, against the computer and against the maths of the programming. But now you're actually going to have the added kind of intricacies of human opponents that you're playing against. So, you know, people will come and maybe attack you, or you can call for help if you get attacked by pirates, and maybe people will come and help you, and you can offer, you know, rewards to people. So there'll be all the kind of multi-dimensional sort of aspects of that sort of massively multiplayer game as well, which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, you sound really passionate about this game. You absolutely love this game, don't you?
Well, it was the thing that got me into, you know, I mean, I really can't say that enough. I've actually spoken to David Braben. David Braben's following me on Twitter. I have to say, it's one of the proudest moments ever in my life. But, you know, his team said to me at one point, oh, you know, thanks for all your help. And I was like, honestly, I feel like it's my duty, because if it hadn't been for, you know, I was going down a spiral of being bad at school, and, you know, I was bored and I didn't get it, and I hated education and I was naughty, and I probably would have ended up in prison had it not been for it gave me something else to focus on. So I am passionate, but I love computers and technology and gaming anyway. I'm a massive MMO fan myself as well. So,
oh, do you play any other games?
Do you know what? I haven't played games properly for about 5 or 6 years, but I was in a Return to Castle Wolfenstein clan. We've had a very bad ladders. This is about 6 or 7 years ago. I like first-person shooters. I like, you know, things like Mass Effect. I played a little bit of Call of Duty. I've also played a bit of EverQuest, I'm afraid. I got quite into EverQuest at one point and ended up being on one of the top raiding guilds in Europe. So, but that's massive time sink. You can't. And I've got a life now. I've just written a book which comes out in March, a business book on how to use the internet. So, and unfortunately, you can't do shit and be really into gaming. It's one or the other.
Yeah, I get that a lot with people I meet.
And I like to do things too. You know, I've got a massive sort of control freak complex where I need to be the best I can at something. And trouble with games, especially multiplayer games, you can't be on top unless you are spending as much time as the people who are on top are spending. And some people do nothing other than play games, so it's kind of frustrating to go on, you know, a first-person server and just get headshotted every time on spawn by somebody who's, you know, like a 14-year-old kid who's got nothing to do all day other than play the game. It's like, yeah, all right.
Yeah, I've got a friend like that. I walked into his house one time. He's a big player of World of Warcraft. I walked into his house one time. He had a bucket next to his. He was going to do this huge raid thing. I'm not even sure. I haven't really played it myself. And a bucket next to his couch. He says, "I haven't left this couch in 3 days." It's like, I don't even want to know what that bucket's for then.
No, it's gross. Do you know what though? This is those games. I did a story on it for I think Click actually about 10 years ago. And the thing with those massively multiplayer games, they're actually quite cunning because they've been designed to give you incremental rewards, but they're never ending. So, and kind of they use peer pressure and social pressure to tie you into the game. So you'll start a quest. You know, there's a reason why the big raids and, in fact, any decent-sized dungeons will require a number of players and a spread across the different classes. So you get tied into a quest series with six other people or five other people if it's a one group quest, or if it's a raiding scenario, then it could be up to four groups, which is, you know, 24 people, and you get to that scenario and suddenly you are tied into hours and hours and hours of being there, and if you drop out, everybody loses. So you have a huge social peer pressure to stay with the crew to the end, you know, and massive rewards at the end of it. And people forget that these are just pixels, you know, they're parading around in their shiny armor with their big fat sword or whatever, and they think that it actually means something. And then you kind of like wake up one day and look around you and go, oh, do you know what? There are far more important things to life than having the best set of armor on the server. So,
well, it is something. I mean, it is something you can say.
I really enjoyed my time raiding and playing MMOs, and I'm glad that I have the strength. I think most people get out of it when it's time for them to move on. Do you know what I mean? But
yeah, when it becomes a job, that's when you've probably got to quit the game.
Yeah,
that's what I've always thought anyway.
I was doing 8 hours. I'd do 8 hours working, and then I'd do 8 hours raiding, and then 4 hours sleeping, and that was it. That was my life for a spell. But I predict there's going to be some element of regression to that when Dangerous comes out in March 2014. So I'm going to make sure I clear my diary and give myself a good couple of months to just completely overdose on it for a few months, get it out of my system.
Yeah, definitely. So let's talk about the book then. What's it about? Obviously set in the Elite Dangerous universe.
Exactly. To be honest with you, I don't know a massive amount more than that at the moment, which is what's so incredible about Kickstarter, because these people are just putting faith in my ability to produce a piece of fiction that they'll enjoy reading. When I started the Kickstarter, I literally said on it, I have no clue what it's going to be about, but it will be a comedy. It will be inspired by the wit of Douglas Adams, so it'll be like an action comedy, and hopefully a bit random, and hopefully it will just make you smile and give you a bit of a fantastical journey through, you know, whatever storyline I'll come up with. That was as much as I had when I launched the Kickstarter. More's been coming to me now, and so I now have kind of like a rough outline, and I've posted a couple of videos up on the Kickstarter, which is still running till the 4th of Feb, so go along there and have a look. And there's one of my supporters, Spatial Katana, and his lovely lady brought me a video sequence of spaceships and planets and jump gates and stuff, and so I did a bit of a teaser to that, and I've done other bits and pieces along the way. I repurposed the Elite Dangerous trailers as well, and put some voice on that, or put some text on that. It's basically about a character called April. Don't know what her surname is yet. She's a female trader. She's not a terribly good trader, and through a series of events, she ends up basically losing everything, losing her ship, losing her money, losing her family and her livelihood and her home, and she's just basically destitute, and she gets offer that she can't refuse, which is essentially to become an assassin. But she turns out to be the worst assassin that the galaxy has ever known, not through any kind of like sentiment or conscience, but she is unable to kill, because every time she arrives to kill somebody, something happens that means, I don't want to give too much away, but every time she tries to kill somebody, something happens that stops her from killing somebody. So she gets this can you hear that? That's my dinner binging, by the way. That's okay. She gets a reputation for being this, this sort of adept assassin, when actually she's not been able to kill anyone yet. So, and it's kind of like a comedy of errors as we go through, and she gets more and more pissed off with the situation because she can't seem to fulfill any of her dreams or destinies. And eventually it reaches ahead, and I've got a really good idea for a great scene towards the end, which will be quite funny, hopefully. And we're going for an audiobook on the Kickstarter now, a professionally produced audiobook version.
I have seen that.
Yeah, so if we manage to get up to the amount, I mean, we're up to 13,000 now, and that's already enough to make the audiobook, to be honest with you. But if we can get the goals of 15,500 for the sort of basically produced one, and then 17,700 for the sort of all singing, all dancing with sound effects and the music beds and whatnot. But it's going to be done by a professional studio in London, and David Raven's going to play a cameo role for me. So, and I send myself off into sort of like giggling fits in the corner when I think about all of the tricks that I'm going to play on the reader along the way. I think it should be a good fun read. And I've posted a few bits of, you know, scenes that I've written and stuff to give people an idea of how it's going to be written. And everyone seems pretty, you know, pretty up for it at the moment, which is really cool. So.
Oh, excellent. I mean, I've read that extract you put on the Kickstarter. It looked pretty good. Yeah. I enjoyed reading that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of like the style. It was kind of hastily written, because the other course is I hadn't planned for this, so it's kind of been a bit of a roller coaster ride from just after Christmas, and I've got stuff for my book launch, which is coming out, Working the Cloud, which is a business that's coming out in March. So I kind of had a full-on schedule anyway. So what I've been able to do in terms of making trailer videos and, you know, and teasers and sort of sample text has just been what I can fit in the evenings and weekends. So, you know, it's not as polished as I would like it to be, but it seems to have been received quite well, which is I'm really relieved about.
Okay, so do you have a background in writing, or is this like kind of like your first attempt, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, the only thing I ever really got on with at school was writing, and I got into television actually through a dare in 1995. I ended up doing sales, selling CD manufacturing for games companies because I was, you know, I was into games, and I didn't think I really had any opportunities other than selling because I was quite talking, so I did that. But then one of my customers dared me. They saw an advert for a young and funky female presenter wanted for a Nickelodeon computer game show called Fish and Chips. And I went for it. And I think because I was the only one who really wasn't that bothered about getting the job, I got them. And then I wrote round to a load of magazines and said, I'm on telly, get a job. And EMAP gave me a job on one of their magazines, which 6 months later went bust. I then loads of contacts in magazines and stuff in London, so I ended up freelancing, and that was back in 95, so I've been freelancing ever since then, you know, working in television. I write my own scripts. There's the writing, just the bit that I really love, and I think which is what makes my TV presenting perhaps stand out a little bit more, is because I write the stuff myself and I'm not just a mouthpiece for, you know, somebody else. And I've been writing fiction. I've been writing short stories, and I've self-published a couple of short stories, and I've also self-published I've written a full-length novel which didn't get published, but I got some very favourable responses from some publishers. But unfortunately, it's about at a time when Harry Potter was really popular, so that's kind of one in the bottom drawer. But it's just, especially, you know, I'm a science fiction fan, science fiction and fantasy. You know, I like Douglas Adams, I like Stephen King's fantasy stuff, Carl Hiaasen. I love all that kind of sort of like slightly quirky off the wall sci-fi stuff, and that's what I'm going to write. And it's so difficult to get publishers to back you as an unknown writer, so which is what's so exciting about the likes of Kickstarter and Indiegogo, is it gives people like me an opportunity to actually, you know, find my audience and say to my audience, look, do you fancy taking a punt on this with me? And they, you know, they're well behind it, and all I've got to do now is actually deliver something that makes them happy.
No pressure. So you're very familiar with science fiction then?
Yeah, I've always been a reader. I'm a reader. We call ourselves a reader. So I have always loved reading science fiction. I've probably read everything that Stephen King's ever written. You know, I really like recently as well people like Patrick Ness. Which is the Chaos Walking series. That was really good. Who else? Charlie Higson did a really good series. I like horrors as well. So Charlie Higson did a really good fantasy horror about zombies taking over London. So and that was really cool. So, yeah, I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've been currently reading the Dark Tower series by Stephen King.
Yeah, that's the most awesome ever. You know, you have to read as well. When you finish the Dark Tower series, books 1 to 7, right, they're big as well, Dark Tower series, and then you move on to The Talisman, which was by Stephen King and Peter Straub. And if you like the Wizard and Glass Dark Tower series, you will love... I cried when it was over. I didn't want it to be over. And then after The Talisman, you want to read Black House by, again, Stephen King and Peter Straub. People don't realize that he's just a brilliant, brilliant fantasy writer as well.
He really is. I love his work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you tend to think of Stephen King, don't you, and sort of see the horror first, and all, you know, sort of all the limbs and Harry and all that kind of stuff. And he's for me, I think it's his. It's the real sort of true fantasy stuff rather than the full on horror, scary stuff that really define him as a writer.
No, I absolutely love the horror. I mean, when growing up, my parents wouldn't let me watch The Shining until I read The Shining first, the book, and then watched the film. The book is just terrifying.
Yeah. Well, the brilliant thing about writing written word, and which is why I love it so much, is because I've got quite a high threshold for horror. I don't like blood and gore. I'm not sort of like really into just full on blood and gore, but I've got quite a high threshold for sort of tension kind of horror. And the thing about the human mind is if you give it some words, it will make for itself the perfect mind movie, that, you know, the perfectly pitched and perfectly toned mind movie. It will be the maximum that you can take and no more. So you will get the most thrill from the piece that you're reading. Movies, you're kind of like bound by, you know, what the director saw and what they believe to be the, either the maximum or the minimum. And everyone's got different, you know, different levels. And the great thing about a writer is they can write it. Someone like Stephen King will write something that lets your mind set the level of how scary you want it to be.
Now, I can completely sympathise with that. The Shining, the book, was way scarier than the film, in my opinion. Because it is that level. It's like you're thinking about it. It's not you're just watching it. You're actually considering things and etc. That's what makes it scary, yeah.
It's like the Alien films as well, you know? The first one was the best because you almost hardly saw the scary thing. It's all just like, you know, it was coming and it was tension of what, you know, what is coming. And when they got a bit clever with CGI and actually making the alien, you know, and revealing it to you, then suddenly you're kind of then bound by their vision of what it looks like. You know, am I making sense?
No, that makes complete sense. I mean, horror films nowadays... When I went to see Sinister recently, I don't know if you've seen Sinister?
I haven't, no.
It's actually quite good. It's a good twist at the end. I won't go into that. But you can kind of tell the bits that are going to make you jump. I mean, they make the jump anyway, but you can tell when it's coming. And it's the same with most horror films nowadays. There's no like real big twist that you didn't see coming. Except, obviously, the twist at the end.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I love as well, what you say about twists. And I would say probably all of my short stories that I've written, twist in the tale stories. And, you know, that's one of the things I really delight in, a good storyteller, is actually not being able to tell the ending. And I do, you know, I sit there and I'll go, oh, this is how it's going to end, and that's how it's going to end. And 9 times out of 10, you're right. And then you get frustrated because you've ruined it for yourself by, you know, guessing what it was going to be before you got to the end. And actually, I, you know, I wish I could just turn that gene off in my head so I could enjoy a story for a story's sake. But that's, I love to find a writer where you don't know where it's going to end up. And I hope that that's something that I'll bring to my story. I certainly, you know, I'm delighting myself with the idea that I am just going to take my readers on a convoluted journey through a storyline that they're just going to be going, what just happened? Oh my god, I didn't know that was going to happen. So hopefully,
yeah, definitely that must make a really good story.
Yeah, definitely twist in the tale. It's got to have a twist in the tale. Do you remember the old Tales of the Unexpected, and that, you know, do 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 do?
Oh yeah, I remember those. Watched those when I was later.
Yeah, that was like the Saturday early evening TV where you'd sort of sit down and sort of hide behind the sofa or hide behind a cushion. As Tales of the Unexpected.
Oh yeah, I also remember watching. Well, I don't think it was on English television, but I remember watching the Twilight Show. My dad used to get them all the way over from America.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, that was some twisted stuff as well.
That's good, it's all good. They don't make them like that anymore. I'd hate to sound like a bit of an old fogey, but, you know, it's more and more, well, maybe we're coming out the other side of it a little bit, but certainly into the sort of like the 90s and the noughties, the 2000s, you know, we got clever enough with CGI and technology for the filmmakers to go, oh, and game makers as well to go, oh, let's just stuff it full of special effects and sound effects and, you know, and make it really big and high budget. And they forget about it. You need a really good story at the heart of these things if they're going to actually take the viewer or the listener or the reader on any kind of journey at all that's meaningful. That's why I think a lot of entertainment is so throwaway these days, because there's, You know, it might have had a lot of money spent on it, but at its heart, where's the story, you know?
Yeah, you need a good story, definitely. That's why old stuff is much better, because the special effects are absolutely rubbish. But the story is fantastic. You watch it just for the story.
Exactly. A friend of mine bought a couple of years ago, or it's probably 5 years ago now, bought the mini series, and then we got the 1970s version, you know, the old the mini series, which I don't know if you saw, they remade the series actually in a couple of years ago, and it was rubbish. But you know, and it was actually the old mini series was rubbish too, but in a different way. It was so, the act was so cheesy, it was just ridiculous. But it, because of that, it was very sort of camp and entertaining. But this basic story was just really good, you know. It was really plausible and had twists and turns that you didn't expect in it, and you know, a bit of humour and a bit of tension and lots of light and shade, and that's, you know, that really for me makes it a story shine.
Yeah, definitely. So what's your favourite book from Douglas Adams, and how does it relate to your work? Well, this book even.
I think probably my favourite book has to be The Talisman by Stephen King, actually. I mean, or you see, it's really difficult not to say that the Douglas Adams, I love obviously the Hitchhiker's Guide trilogy in four parts, but also his Dirk Gently stuff as well, the holistic investigation agency.
See, hardly anyone knows Dirk Gently. No, it's fantastic. I've got all the books from Dirk Gently.
No, I know. And, you know, I mean, I was having a chat with somebody the other day saying they actually think Dirk Gently's better. And I don't know, I would say it's better than Hitchhiker's Guide. It's certainly on a par. It's something quite different. But yeah, it would have to be a toss-up between The Hitchhiker's Guide and Stephen King and Peter Straub's Talisman, I think.
Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, it was fantastic. I think that was one of the first books I ever read for science fiction, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Would have been a good start as well to science fiction.
Really good start. And then I moved on to Isaac Asimov, which is generally quite boring, actually.
I know. Well, I tried reading some Bruce Sterling as well a few months ago, and it's just a little bit. He's a little bit too smug. Me? Do you know what I mean? It's like he's just a little too smug and clever about all of his sort of references in the future. And I think people like Douglas Adams weren't trying to impress anyone. They just were turning on their imagination and seeing what came out. And that, I think. I don't think you need to try too hard when you're writing. If you do, then it always feels, especially not science fiction, because it always feels a little bit belaboured, I think, if you try too hard.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with that. So how does your work relate to Douglas Adams, then?
My work? I don't know, really. My work is really random. I mean, I just do stuff. I've been freelance for, like, since 95, so I guess it's, like, 18 years now. But for me, variety is the thing that keeps me alive. I can't bear, you know, even if it's something really cool, if I have to do the same thing every day for too long, I get really fidgety and frustrated. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know that Douglas Adams does have anything necessarily to do with my work, only that he was a big influence on the stuff that I read when I was growing up. I want to write stuff that entertains or informs people. That's what I'm about. So, you know, sometimes that will be a 140 character tweet. Sometimes it will be, you know, a blog post, or it might be, you know, something a little bit meatier on Google Plus or Facebook. Or, you know, sometimes it will be a full length 60,000 word book, which is what I've got coming out in March, and that's a factual book. It's aimed at businesses and, you know, small businesses and entrepreneurs to teach them how, why to use the internet to improve their business. But it's still just telling stories. You know, I still try to make it entertaining and give it a narrative. To writing short stories, which, you know, short stories and fiction. And now this is my dream now, to actually write a full length piece of fiction and have it published and have people read it and enjoy it is, you know, I once I've done this, I can actually die happy. Hopefully I won't, but you know, go, yeah, okay, that's the one thing that I wanted to do when I was growing up, and I would have done it, and hopefully it will go down really well, and I'll get the opportunity to write another one. So I'll just take each day as it comes, really, and you've got to have a big catching net ready to catch the opportunities that come your way. And sometimes you stand there for ages and ages and your hand gets all sweaty and you think, oh, is anything going to happen? And then suddenly a big fat opportunity just sort of like lands right in the middle of your path and you go, you've got to pick it up and run with it. And so that's what I'm doing.
So what will you do with all the money? What will you do with all the money that you've raised so far?
Right, okay. Well, it's all spent already. The license, which was $4,500, so, and the thing about Kickstarters is they take about it works out to be about 15-20% you lose, because they take fees and charges to transfer the money to you, and then they put VAT on it as well, so you lose about 20% ish. And then $4,500 I had to pay for the license for the book to write the piece of fiction, which is what I paid to Frontier Developments, the makers of the game. For that, I have the royalty-free right to write one piece of fiction, which they will support to some extent within the storyline of the game. So there's a bit of negotiation to happen along the way about how that rolls out. The second stretch goal, which was to, if we could get it up to $5,500, that next £1,000 is earmarked to spend on having my final manuscript professionally edited and proofread. So it's a really, you know, really clean, good story. Then the next £500 to take it to £6,000, that is going to be spent on having it professionally laid out and typeset for the ebook, because there's a, you know, there's professional things that you need to get done. You don't have to, but it will look a bit sort of like hokey and sort of homemade if you don't. If I spend £500, I can get it properly laid out and made to look all lovely for the ebook. The ebook's £5,500. The next £500 is for a paperback book. So then I will pay for the cover and the layout for the paperback book. And then, so what people can do there is they can then, those that have pledged up to £5 on my Kickstarter will have the opportunity to buy at cost price a print-on-demand paperback book when it's ready next year. So that's the way that sort of level works. And then from 6,000 to 15,500, there's a massive leap, and that is to pay for a professionally produced, recorded, finished, and distributed ebook. And everyone who's pledged up to £25. Will get a free copy of the ebook when it's ready. Audiobook. And then if we can get up to 17,700, they will get. I will have that professionally recorded and edited audiobook. Will be fully produced with sound effects and bedding music and stuff like that. So it'll be 6.5. It's unabridged. So it's going to be 6.5 hours worth of audiobook. With a cameo role from a couple of people, including David Braben, and hopefully it'll be really enjoyable, and it'll be DRM-free, so you can watch it, listen to it on any platform. You can even share it with your friends if you want, although I'd rather they bought a copy, because it would actually be nice to earn some money out of this eventually.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not getting any money, you know, I'm going to spend everything that comes from the Kickstarter on writing the book. I will be writing the book free of charge. But that's kind of how you work as a fiction writer as well, you know, or really any kind of writer. It's a speculative job. So I am writing a piece of fiction in the hope that people will want to buy enough copies that it will make it worth my while having spent the time writing it. It's the same with my fact book that's coming out. I got a small advance from my publisher, but not enough to make it actually a financially rewarding thing yet. But hopefully, once it's published and it's out there, enough people will buy a copy that will actually make it, you know, worth my while. But it's not something you do to get rich writing. Very, very few writers make any kind of worthwhile living out of it, you know. I mean, people think, you know, they think writer and they see people like J.K. Rowling. That's my cat, just up, if you can hear the ringing. I think, or J.K. Rowling or Stephen King, and they are like the top cream of the crowd, and 99.999% of writers who do it professionally just about scrape living.
That's true. I completely agree with that. A lot of people do have a misconception with writers.
No, exactly. And it's a craft. You do it for love. You definitely don't write for notoriety. The other thing as well, especially with social media, is you put yourself out there too. You know, even when I'm writing my factual stuff, I publish it wherever I publish it, and people have opinions about it, and not everybody's opinion is a good opinion. You kind of have to take the rough with the smooth. You've got to expect that not everybody's going to be on the same level as you, on most things that you do. And you know, when you put yourself on telly as well, then you open yourself up to visual criticism as well. You know, I mean, I had my dad very upset the other week because he got on Facebook for the first time, and he was like going through, and somebody had posted a message on my Facebook page saying that I looked like I was about waiting for my friends to come round in a taxi so we could go out and drink Lambrini for the night. Like, upset about it, and I was just like, do you know what? It's just, honestly, you just have to ignore it, because there'll always be someone who's got an opinion who wants to share it with you that perhaps won't be very nice to hear. And especially when you're putting creative work out into the public domain, yeah, it's a taste thing. And if you don't enjoy my writing, then that's fair enough. And some people decide that they want to let you know that in no uncertain terms. You've just got to get thick skin and go, yeah, all right, whatever.
You have to take the good with the bad, don't you?
Yeah. It's the same. I mean, yeah, I can't complain. I have an amazing life. I get to surf the internet, play with gadgets, and write stories, and that's how I earn my living. So I wouldn't have it any other way, and I wouldn't even presume to complain about it. But you do have to take that rough with the very, very smooth of the awesome job that I have.
Oh, excellent, yeah. I think I'm just about out of questions as well.
Oh, cool.
I really don't want this to stop, actually. I'm having a great, great time.
Your podcast this week as well, so it's good to find another piece of interesting listening material to keep me company on my long walks to and from the station. So I'm well into my podcasts for that. So yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, give it a listen.
Cool. And everybody listening, please come onto the Kickstarter and pledge your £25, and you'll get an audiobook and my adoration and thanks and love, and you get to spend the next year being very silly with me in a Google Circles Hangouts scenario where I'll be chatting to all the people who've invested in the book. So it should be a good fun ride. So hopefully people will come on and join me.
Yeah, plug that up. Do you have anything else to add? 'Cause I'm out. I'm done.
Thank you very much for having me. I've got a fish pie in the oven, so I think I might go and eat that now, because the cat's looking very very interested in the oven as well right now.
Okay then, I think that puts us to the end then.
Cool, thanks for having me. Bye, Fortune Books, heroes, people.